Chapter 5. Roaring bachelor's supper at the Aphanglis, as at a state dowager's dinner table in the Faubourg Saint Honor. Such pleasant old boys are very profitable acquaintances, let me tell you, and lucky is the young man who has one or two such friends in his list. Hurrying on Foxen in his dress, I conducted him, panting, up to the major's quadrium, where we were cheerfully bidden to come in. The little gentleman was in his traveling jacket, and occupied in painting, elegantly, one of those natty pairs of boots in which he daily promenaded the boulevards. A couple of pairs of tough buff gloves had been undergoing some pipe-claying operation under his hands. No man stepped out so spick and span, with a hat so nicely brushed, with a stiff cravat tied so neatly under a fat little red face, with a blue frock coat so scrupulously fitted to a punchy little person, as Major British, about whom we have written these two pages. He stared rather hardly at my companion, but gave me a kind shake of the hand, and we proceeded at once to business. Major British, said I, we want your advice in regard to an unpleasant affair which has just occurred to my friend Pogson. Pogson, take a chair. You must know, sir, that Mr. Pogson, coming from Calais the other day, encountered, in the diligence, a very handsome woman. British winked at Pogson, who, wretched as he was, could not help feeling pleased. Mr. Pogson was not more pleased with this lovely creature than was she with him, for, it appears, she gave him her card, invited him to her house, where he has been constantly, and has been received with much kindness. I see, says British. Her husband the Baron, now it's coming, said the Major, with a grin colon her husband is jealous, I suppose, and there is a talk of the Bois de Bowlen. My dear sir, you can't refuse. It's not that, said Pogson, wagging his head passionately. Her husband the Baron seemed quite as much taken with Pogson as his lady was, and has introduced him to some very distinct friends of his own set. Last night one of the Baron's friends gave a party in honor of my friend Pogson, who lost 48 pounds at cards, before he was made drunk, and heaven knows how much after. Not a shilling, by sacred heaven, not a shilling, yelled out Pogson. Stir the supper I had such an edich, I couldn't do anything but fall asleep on the sofa. You had such an edich, sir, says British, sternly, who piques himself on his grammar and pronunciation, and scorns a cockney. Such a cheatache, sir, replied Pogson, with much meekness. The unfortunate man is brought home at 2 o'clock, as tipsy as possible, dragged upstairs, senseless, to bed, and, on waking, receives a visit from his entertainer of the night before, a lord's son, Major, a tip-top fellow, who brings a couple of bills that my friend Pogson is said to have signed. Well, my dear fellow, the thing's quite simple, he must pay them. I can't pay them. He can't pay them, said we both in a breath. Colin Pogson is a commercial traveler, with 30 shillings a week, and how the deuce is he to pay £500? A bagman, sir. And what right has a bagman to gamble? Gentlemen gamble, sir. Tradesmen, sir, have no business with the amusements of the gentry. What business had you with barons and lord's sons, sir? Serve you right, sir. Sir, says Pogson, with some dignity, merit, and not birth, is the criterion of a man. I despise an hereditary aristocracy, and admire only nature's gentlemen. For my part, I think that a British merch, hold your tongue, sir, bounced out the Major, and don't lecture me. Don't come to me, sir, with your slang about nature's gentlemen, nature's tomfools, sir. Did nature open a cash account for you at a banker's, sir? Did nature give you an education, sir? What do you mean by competing with people to whom nature has given all these things? Stick to your backs, Mr. Pogson, and your bagmen, and leave barons and their like to their own ways. Yes, but, Major, here cried that faithful friend, who has always stood by Pogson, they won't leave him alone. The Honorable Gent says I must fight if I don't pay, whimpered Sam.
What?
Fight you? Do you mean that the Honorable Gent, as you call him, will go out with a bagman? He doesn't know I'm a commercial man, blushingly said Sam. He fancies I'm a military gent. The Major's gravity was quite upset at this absurd notion, and he laughed outrageously. Hi, the fact is, sir, said I, that my friend Pogson, knowing the value of the title of captain, and being complimented by the Baroness on his warlike appearance, said, boldly, he was in the army. He only assumed the rank in order to dazzle her weak imagination, never fancying that there was a husband, and a circle of friends, with whom he was afterwards to make an acquaintance. And then, you know, it was too late to withdraw. A pretty pickle you have put yourself in, Mr. Pogson, by making love to other men's wives, and calling yourself names, said the Major, who was restored to good humor. And pray, who is the Honorable Gent? The Earl of Cinqbur's son, says Pogson, the Honorable Tom Ringwood. I thought it was some such character. And the Baron is the Baron de Florval Delval? The very same. And his wife, a black-haired woman, with a pretty foot and ankle, calls herself Athanase, and is always talking about her Trent Duans? Why, sir, that woman was an actress on the boulevard, when we were here in 15. She's no more his wife than I am. Delville's name is Chicot. The woman is always traveling between London and Paris. I saw she was hooking you at Calais. As he has hooked 10 men, in the course of the last 2 years, in this very way. She lent you money, didn't she? S. And she leans on your shoulder, and whispers, play half for me, apostrophe and somebody wins it, and the poor thing is as sorry as you are, and her husband storms and rages, and insists on double stakes. And she leans over your shoulder again, and tells every card in your hand to your adversary, and that's the way it's done, Mr. Pogson. I've been A.D., I see I have, said Pogson, very humbly. Well, sir, said the Major, in consideration, not of you, sir, for, give me leave to tell you, Mr. Pogson, that you are a pitiful little scoundrel in consideration for my Lord Cinqbur's, sir, with whom, I am proud to say, I am intimate. The Major dearly loved the Lord, and was, by his own showing, acquainted with half the peerage, will aid you in this affair. Your cursed vanity, sir, and want of principle, has set you, in the first place, intriguing with other men's wives. And if you had been shot for your pains, a bullet would have only served you right, sir. You must go about as an impostor, sir, in society, and you pay richly for your swindling, sir, by being swindled yourself. But, as I think your punishment has been already pretty severe, I shall do my best, out of regard for my friend, Lord Cinqbur's, to prevent the matter going any farther, and I recommend you to leave Paris without delay. Now let me wish you a good morning. Wherewith British made a majestic bow, and began giving the last touch to his varnished boots. We departed. Poor Sam perfectly silent and chapfallen. And I meditating on the wisdom of the half-pay philosopher, and wondering what means he would employ to rescue Pogson from his fate. What these means were I know not, but Mr. Ringwood did not make his appearance at 6, and, at 8, a letter arrived for Mr. Pogson, commercial traveler, and C&C. It was blank inside, but contained his 2 bills. Mr. Ringwood left town, almost immediately, for Vienna. Nor did the Major explain the circumstances which caused his departure, but he muttered something about knew some of his old tricks, threatened police, and made him disgorge directly. Mr. Ringwood is, as yet, young at his trade, and I have often thought it was very green of him to give up the bills to the Major, who, certainly, would never have pressed the matter before the police, out of respect for his friend, Lord Cinqbur's. The Fates of July. In a letter to the editor of the Young Gay Beacon. Paris, July 30th, 1839. We have arrived here just in time for the Fates of July. You have read, no doubt, of that glorious revolution which took place here 9 years ago, and which is now commemorated annually, in a pretty facetious manner, by gun-firing, student processions, pole-climbing for silver spoons, gold watches and legs of mutton, monarchical orations, and what not, and sanctioned, moreover, by Chamber of Deputies, with a grant of a couple of 100,000 francs, to defray the expenses of all the crackers, gun firings, and legs of mutton aforesaid. There is a new fountain in the Place Louis Quinze, otherwise called the Place Louis Seize, or else the Place de la Revolution, or else the Place de la Concorde, who can say why? Which, I am told, is to run bad wine during certain hours tomorrow, and there would have been a review of the National Guards and the line only, since the fichai business, reviews are no joke, and so this latter part of the festivity has been discontinued. Do you not laugh, O pharaohs of Bungay, at the continuance of a humbug such as this, at the humbugging anniversary of a humbug? The King of the Barricades is, next to the Emperor Nicholas, the most absolute sovereign in Europe, yet there is not in the whole of this fair kingdom of France a single man who cares sixpence about him, or his dynasty. Except, mayhap, a few hangers-on at the chateau, who eat his dinners, and put their hands in his purse. The feeling of loyalty is as dead as old Charles X. The chambers have been laughed at, the country has been laughed at, all the successive ministries have been laughed at,
and you know who is the wag that has amused himself with them all,
and, behold, here come 3 days at the end of July, and cannons think it necessary to fire off, squibs and crackers to blaze and fizz, fountains to run wine, kings to make speeches, and subjects to crawl up greasy mats to cocken in token of gratitude and rejoicence publique. My dear sir, in their aptitude to swallow, to utter, to enact humbugs, these French people, from majesty downwards, beat all the other nations of this earth. In looking at these men, their manners, dresses, opinions, politics, actions, history, it is impossible to preserve a grave countenance. Instead of having Carlyle to write a history of the French Revolution, I often think it should be handed over to Dickens or Theodore Hook. And oh, where is the Rabelais, to be the faithful historian of the last phase of the Revolution, the last glorious 9 years, of which we are now commemorating the last glorious 3 days? I had made a vow not to say a syllable on the subject, although I have seen, with my neighbors, all the gingerbread stalls down the Champs-Élysées, and some of the catafalques erected to the memory of the heroes of July, where the students and others, not connected personally with the victims, and not having in the least profited by their deaths, come and weep. But the grief shown on the first day is quite as absurd and fictitious as the joy exhibited on the last. The subject is one which admits of much wholesome reflection and food for mirth, and, besides, is so richly treated by the French themselves that it would be a sin and a shame to pass it over. Allow me to have the honor of translating, for your edification, an account of the first day's proceedings. It is mighty amusing, to my thinking. Celebration of the days of July. Today, Saturday, funeral ceremonies, in honor of the victims of July, were held in the various edifices consecrated to public worship. These edifices, with the exception of some churches, especially that of the Petits Peres, were uniformly hung with black on the outside. The hangings bore only this inscription: 27, 28, 29 July, 1830, surrounded by a wreath of oak leaves. In the interior of the Catholic churches, it had only been thought proper to dress little catafalques, as for burials of the third and fourth class. Very few clergy attended, but a considerable number of the National Guard. The synagogue of the Israelites was entirely hung with black, and a great concourse of people attended. The service was performed with the greatest pomp. In the Protestant temples there was likewise a very full attendance. Apologetical discourses on the Revolution of July were pronounced by the pastors. The absence of M. de Quillan, Archbishop of Paris, and of many members of the superior clergy, was remarked at Notre Dame. The civil authorities attended service in their several districts. The poles, ornamented with TRI-colored flags, which formerly were placed on Notre Dame, were, it was remarked, suppressed. The flags on the Pont Neuf were, during the ceremony, only half-mast high, and covered with crepe. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The tombs of the Louvre were covered with black hangings, and adorned with TRI-colored flags. In front and in the middle was erected an expiatory monument of a pyramidal shape, and surmounted by a funeral vase. These tombs were guarded by the municipal guard, the troops of the line, the surgeons de ville, town patrol, and a brigade of agents of police in plain clothes, under the orders of peace officer Vassal. Between 11 and 12 o'clock, some young men, to the number of 400 or 500 assembled on the Place de la Bourse, one of them bearing a TRI-colored banner with an inscription, to the Mains of July. Ranging themselves in order, they marched five abreast to the March des Innocents. On their arrival, the municipal guards of the Hallux Draps, where the post had been doubled, issued out without arms, and the town sergeants placed themselves before the market, to prevent the entry of the procession. The young men passed in perfect order, and without saying a word, only lifting their hats as they defiled before the tombs. When they arrived at the Louvre, they found the gates shut, and the garden evacuated. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.